today is March 10th, 2015. This is Journal Aqua, and I'm here with Dr. Ernesto Gonzalez-Martinez at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. We are conducting an oral history interview for the Center for the History of Medicine. Dr. Gonzalez, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, you may.
Excellent, thank you. So, if we could just begin, could you tell me about yourself and your family and where you grew up?
Yes, I was born in Aguadilla, a very small town on the west side of Puerto Rico. Obviously, back 77 years ago now, 76 years. We were very poor. Prior to my birth, I understand from speaking to the family and my mother specifically that my mother was a homeless person. She was raised by my grandmother, who had six children. My mother was the youngest of the six. And her husband had died already, and so they didn't have a home to sleep or to live in. And according to my mother, they used to live on their house up in the hills in my hometown, where my grandmother shared that facility, which was boarded with cardboard and no facilities for water or disposal of anything. And my grandmother was living there with my mother and two other siblings of my mother, of which two of them had tuberculosis. And imagine they were living in cots with no sanitary facilities. And those two siblings of my mother died shortly after. So my mother eventually lived with my grandmother there until eventually she married my father, and then my aunt, she was the sister of my father, gave my mother and her husband, my father, gave them a small house, a rented house for them to move into. And so that's how we were born with a home. But my mother, for several years, was completely homeless. As a matter of fact, she could not go beyond second grading of school because she had nothing to wear. So eventually she had to stay home because she didn't have shoes to be able to go to school. So after second grade, she's basically stay home, and that's all her education. Even though she learned to read and write in her second grade, and she used to write very well and read very, very well, and she used to teach us early on to read the comics and things like that, and she was always trying to stimulate us to read and to learn about the world, which in our case was a very narrow-minded world because we were so poor. The resources that we have were very, very limited. But it was obvious that from the beginning that she was interested in our education. And even though she was a widow when I was 5 years old, she was always sitting with us, teaching us, reading to us, very interested about all the school activities, to make sure that our grades were as good as they could be. And luckily, either we learned well from our mother, my brother and myself, and we became very good students. You know, it's obviously at the beginning was forced upon us to be good students from my mother. She was a very strict person, very caring person, but very strict at the same time. And we go back to the times where spanking was not a big deal, you know, and that was the way that you discipline your children. Now obviously that's I said, no, no. But I remember getting spanked until I was probably about 7 years of age. Always done in a respectful way. She never hit us on the face, any other place, was always on the buttocks with a message. So we learned from those spanking and the message that went along with it. So we were disciplined well after 7 years of age, but just her looks was enough to put us in the right path. But she was always interested, and education was always her primary reason, because she knew that was the only way that we could get out of these slums. Imagine living with my mother. Her mother was living with us, and my brother and myself. My father died when I was 5 years old. My brother was 6.5 years old. And it was amazing that at that point, most of the women, you know, that were widowed usually will look for a husband to help raising the family, and she decided she would never get married again. That was it. She was very loyal to my father, who was an alcoholic. He died of tuberculosis and alcoholism, and I don't remember too much about him because, as I said, he died when I was 5 years old. And it was always all the remembrances that we have in our family life was with our mother, but she decided never to marry it again. She would dedicate to us no matter what. Many people will advise to go someplace else out of these slums in my hometown, go to New York and get on welfare, and she always said, no, I'll bring them all by myself. And she used to work as a maid, and she also did, you know, crocheting and things like that, you know, on her own at night. She was a very hardworking woman. I mean, I could never envision ever work as hard as my mother did, considering the fact that she was never remunerated, as obviously as I am. So it was amazing to see her sacrifice just for two children, you know. My grandmother died when she was 96 years of age, so she died when I finished medical school. So she was able to see us through the whole process. And my mother obviously died much later, when she was 90. And by that time, I was already married and already a physician. So that's basically the story growing poor. I remember that we did, even when we had a house, small house, we didn't have any water. So she used to carry water from a central public faucet of water supply. She used to carry that on her side with hanging to her skirt, walking it was about a block, carrying water and carrying us together at the same time. So it was just amazing that we had a latrine in that house until I was going to college. So it was a difficult situation at the time. But you know what, it was funny was that with my mother, she was always positive about it. You know, there was never complaints that we were poor. Obviously, she aspired for us to be better, had a better life, but she never really complained. Even when she died, she never really complained that her luck was different. So I think we did learn from her to live a life of positive, you know, thinking. And I think it's for both me and my brother, has been the modus operandi of the way that we envision life. And the other thing is the importance that we give to education. Not only our children, our grandchildren now, they are well educated or on the path to be well educated. And they know that to us, education is the most important part of it, obviously being a good citizen too, but usually those things go together, you know, if you're disciplined enough. So, as I say, you know, it's sometimes we probably even embellish our mother's effort and impact on our lives, but she was an amazing woman. So, for me, all my inspiration of becoming a good citizen, becoming a productive person, be positive about life experiences, and going into medicine, which is a service-oriented profession, I think it's all owed to my mother, and the same with my brother.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's what I was going to ask you next. Did she encourage you to study medicine? Did she help you lead down this path to becoming a physician?
Well, during that time, obviously, you know, our knowledge of life was so limited, you know. I remember, for example, a simple thing like we take for granted, like buying cold cuts, you know, ham and things like that. We never had any idea that you go to a supermarket to buy slice of ham to eat it, you know. So it's we were so naive about life experiences. I remember that we had a doctor that we used to go and see only when we were sick, and there was no prevention back then. Even though our father had died of tuberculosis, we had to be checked every 6 months for tuberculosis in the public service hospital. So we used to go for that checkups. But after that, when we became adolescents, for example, you only go to see the doctor for emergency purposes. And I was the one that was frequently sick, so I used to go there. But never aspired to think, you know, I'm going to be like my doctor, or I'm going to be this way or that way. All what we aspired at that point was to finish, you know, a year by year, you know, go from first grade to second grade to sixth grade, and then you aspire to go to intermediate school, and then you aspire to go to high school, and then once we got to high school, we never expected that would go any further. You know, there was no money to be able to go to college, and so luckily we were good students, so I was an honor student all throughout. So was my brother. And so when we got to finish high school, I had the highest grade of the admission exam to the University of Puerto Rico. So because of that, I qualified to get assistance, which means that I would pay, the government would pay all my expenses to go to college. Because there was two brothers at that point, the law specified that no two brothers would get public assistance. So I could only get it even though he had as good grades as I did. So what he did, he went to the University of Puerto Rico and interviewed and asked to see if he could apply for this assistance. And they had changed the law that same year, the year before. And they told him, yes, you can apply and you can receive. So both of us went to the University of Puerto Rico with all the expenses paid, because that was the only way that we could do it. As a matter of fact, when we were in high school, the principal of the high school was trying to convince my brother to become an assistant teacher, which was a small amount of pay, with no real professional degree, which would have put him there probably for many, many years with no advances in professionally speaking. And he decided that he didn't want to do that. He wanted to go to the university. So to answer your question, you know, we had no idea what a physician is until obviously I got to the University of Puerto Rico. Then you start to expand your horizons and see other people. I went into the sciences field when I was at the University of Puerto Rico, and eventually got into pre-med. So obviously at that point, I started to realize that at least I was in the pathway to become a physician, even though I had no idea what that entailed. You know, it was not probably until my last year at the University of Puerto Rico that I realized how many years it takes, what you have to do, that you have to go through another application process. And at the time, there was only one medical school in Puerto Rico, and it was part of the University of Puerto Rico system, and they only accepted 50 students per year, which is obviously a very small amount. And so to apply and be accepted, you really have to be one of the top students in the whole system. And this was not only students that were applying from the University of Puerto Rico, but there are also other colleges also in Puerto Rico. So you were competing with at least four different universities that were providing students, you know, that were well qualified. And out of those, 50 were only accepted. The rest usually had to go to Mexico or Spain to train in medicine because they couldn't do it in Puerto Rico. So I was one of the lucky ones that was accepted to go into medical school at the University of Puerto Rico. As a matter of fact, at the end of my 4 years of medical school, only 35 of us graduated, so 15 did not graduate. They couldn't do it, or they decided not that medicine was not for them and quit early on in their educational career. So 35 of us eventually finished the medical school in Puerto Rico. Now they have four different medical schools in Puerto Rico. The University of Puerto Rico Medical School accepts 200 students now, and the other ones accept more or less similar numbers. So it's much easier now, obviously, to get into medical school, even though also the population has increased significantly, so it's more people applying. But back then, it was very, very difficult to get into. So that was when I finally got to realize that medicine was a choice for me. Back then, when I was at the University of Puerto Rico, what you think was you could be, if you wanted to do be a professional, you would think about engineering. They used to have a good engineering school in Puerto Rico, and a lot of people gravitated towards engineer, law school, and medical school. That was it. You know, you couldn't think of anything else. Again, that was our narrow knowledge of what things you could do. And I knew that I was not going to be a lawyer. I mean, I was not that kind of person. And I didn't think that I had the skills to be an engineer. Again, narrow-minded, thinking that, you know, you have to be a good mathematician and things like that, which is not necessarily true. But, you know, those limited knowledge just limited me to think, well, if you want to go beyond a college degree, then medicine might be a choice. But understanding also that I was poor and that I didn't have the financial resources, I also wanted to start working and help my mother as soon as I could finish the college education. So the medical school was there, you know, but it was a distant plan for me, and it was probably a second choice rather than the choice of going to work, and which is what I did for 2 years. I finished college and I decided to go to work for 2 years, and then I went into medical school 2 years after I finished college. So that's basically the way that we envision, you know. When we went to University of Puerto Rico, I went into the science fields, and eventually pre-med. My brother went into business education, and eventually he finished his 4 years of college, and he got married early, so he had to go to work as soon as he finished. So he went to be a teacher at the University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez campus. So he became a teacher there. Eventually then he continued his studies, you know, postgraduate studies, and eventually became a professor of economics at the University of Puerto Rico in Mayagüez campus. So eventually both of us were able to attain, you know, the maximum education that we could. Again, all with the serendipity and the lucky strike that all the education was paid by the government. We could not afford to do that.
Wonderful, thank you. So I'm curious, eventually you come up to Boston as part of your dermatology training, but before that, had you served in Vietnam? I wasn't sure about the timeline.
Yes, I did. So I went to medical school, and at the time there was draft. You will be drafted as soon as you reach, I think it was 17 years of age or 18. And so I was drafted then. But what they do at that point was that they postpone the service as long as you're a student. So because I went to college education and eventually to medical school, all my service was postponed. But as soon as I finished my medical school education, when I went into my internship, then I received a letter from the draft board that I was going to serve as soon as I finished my internship. This was in 1967. And when you're drafted, all what you do is you go through, you know, when they ask for the service that you have to give to the armed forces of the United States, you have no idea where you're going to be assigned. All what you know is that you're going to be trained as a physician doctor in the army, and then you don't know where you're going to be assigned to work. And I was assigned to go to Vietnam, so I went to San Francisco during my training, Texas first, and then San Francisco during my training, and then from there I was shipped to Vietnam. In the process, my mother did not know that I was going there. As a matter of fact, she had been living with us sick for 2 years when I was finishing my medical school and doing my internship. She had multiple medical problems, and she was living with us because she had to be taken care of and be close to a facility where she needed to be hospitalized in San Juan. So she was living with us, my wife and my first daughter. And then when I was drafted to serve, then my mother had to go back to my hometown to live alone. And my wife had to go to New York with my daughter so that I could go into the armed forces. You should be aware that Puerto Ricans are born citizens of the United States, and one of our responsibilities is to serve the armed forces, even though we don't vote for the President of the United States. So that's why I was drafted and recruited and eventually went to Vietnam. And so I went to, I was assigned to a place called Pleiku, which is in the kind of mid South Vietnam, they call the Highlands. And I was assigned there as a physician in charge of a battalion, what they call it in the medical corps, a battalion surgeon. Even though you're not a surgeon, you're just a physician coming out of training. And so I had about 300 soldiers assigned to me that I would take care of sick calls, all the emergency vaccinations and everything else. I was responsible to provide that to that battalion. And as well, I would go and assist in, you know, surgical operations in what we used to call a unit where they had surgeons and other physicians, we go there to help as well. But most my responsibility was to the soldiers that were in my battalion. And so I had to travel to visit them in the front. So I used to spend a lot of time in the war zone, you know, living in bunkers, in tents, to go and give vaccinations and attend all the medical needs that they have. So I spent a year in Vietnam doing that. I saw a lot of, obviously, what you expect to see in a war battle, people dying, being attacked by the enemy. As a matter of fact, I was there during the Tet Offensive, which was the biggest offensive of that war, because the enemy decided to join forces and attack us one more time and see if they could defeat us. They didn't, but they killed a lot of our people during that. And it was really the most intense battle of Vietnam in all the years that the war lasted. And so I was there during that time. That was the beginning of 1968. So I was there from 67 to 68. And it was an interesting experience, aside from the fact that you were in the war zone and you're afraid of being killed, you've never been exposed to that kind of persistent and consistent, you know, involvement of war activities, but also the human relations were interesting, because obviously the army soldiers are kind of the low echelon of society. You know, most of them are people who are recruited with no education. They just finish high school and they go into the armed forces. So many of them are not too well educated. They were good ones too. They're good people, in spite of the fact that they were not good at had a good education. But at the same time, you see the biases. People from the South, for example, who didn't believe that a Puerto Rican could be a doctor, for example, or didn't want to be treated by a physician that was from Puerto Rico. Comments that I heard from one that became a very good friend. He was a captain, and he told me we were watching TV, and we were watching on TV Sammy Davis Jr., which, you know, it's a tremendous performer, but he's black. And this guy was sitting in the officers' club with me, and again we became very good friends. He was very helpful to me, but when he started to see that picture of a black performer on TV, he says, that Negro guy, you know, he shouldn't be there. He should be eliminated. You know, it was just making all kinds of crazy comments that all what I could think was, you know, he's probably thinking that he's sitting back home in whatever he came from. I think he was from Oklahoma, that he was probably thinking like his parents have probably trained him to think that black people are not good people. And then I look at him and I start laughing. I said, you know what you're saying? You're sitting next to somebody who's even less than an African American. I'm from Puerto Rico. And so we start laughing, and then suddenly he realized that, you know, he was making a mistake, and that he was bringing all the biases from home into this incident, but he was like that. I mean, he would treat, you know, the African Americans soldiers, he would treat them completely different. So I saw all that, you know, not only with the other soldiers, but even with me as a physician. Luckily, because I was the physician, they all depended on me. I would give them vaccines, I would treat them when they were sick. I was also in charge of sanitation, so I had to check the mess hall to make sure that the food that they were, you know, eating was appropriate for them. I was also involved in the entertainment part of it. So I would be the one that distribute beer and drinks, movies and things like that. So they obviously saw me as a person that they needed to be close to. So I became very good friends with a lot of these people. But understanding of the bias is that I never saw in Puerto Rico, because, you know, there's no real minorities or majorities in Puerto Rico. Even though in Puerto Rico there's still a lot of bigotry, mostly because of the status, financial status. So the poor and the rich, there's a big divide. And I was on that side of the poor people living in Puerto Rico. So I saw that kind of, but in terms of color, or ethnicity, there was nothing like that in Puerto Rico. So that was my first experience to these kind of biases. And it was an interesting phenomenon. So while I was seeing and suffering the battles of the real war, I was also involved in this behavior pattern that I saw in Vietnam. And the worst thing was when I came back from Vietnam, because that was the time where, everybody was opposed to the war, and they included the soldiers as part of the equation. So they felt that we should not have gone to the war, that we should have go to Canada or someplace else, or denied to go to the war zone. So when I came back, I mean, if you were uniformed, uniform in a civilian place, people will scream at you, throw things at you. They keep on saying, why don't you go to Canada or go someplace? And now imagine I'm a Puerto Rican, listening to all these things. And I said, I came to help. I mean, I have no saying in the political issues that happen when the war started or continued, and I'm just here to serve, my country, and to be treated that way. And for many, many years, until probably recently, I decided that I didn't want to think about Vietnam. That was such a bad experience, not so much what happened in Vietnam proper, but what happened in the United States. To be unaccepted by your own peers, it was very, very painful. So I never wore uniform in public places. I would only go and wear the uniform when I go to the base where I was stationed at. And I never thought about staying any longer than 2 years, because I was involved in this kind of attitude of everybody. And that was the time where the hippies were, very strong. And there was a lot of unrest in the United States. And so I lived through all that, and I'm glad that now people think differently about the veterans from the more recent wars. But, I remember comparing myself as a veteran from the veterans from Second World War, which were considered, heroes and very important part of the community, and they were, the government provided a lot of things to them to develop after they came, after the war. Nothing like that happened in Vietnam. People, now there's a lot of concern about post-traumatic syndrome. Back then, everybody, the thinking process back then, even by the government, was that we were all crazy. Coming back, we were all crazy, and we were not good people. And there was nothing really available to make you better as a citizen coming back as a veteran. Luckily, obviously, I was a physician already, so I didn't really suffer too much of that. I just went on with my professional life. But I could see, the people who had no education coming back, who had really nothing to aspire to, because neither the government, neither the citizens, everybody was against the soldiers. So it was a bad experience, so I was a captain there because, as a physician, you go as a lieutenant, immediately make captain. I won a bronze medal. I don't know why. probably for being in the war zone, but it's supposed to be a, you know, one of those awards that you receive in the armed forces. So that was the experience. Yeah, and again, it prepared me for what was coming on later on in my life as a professional, you know, dealing with diversity and dealing with minority issues, because I was part of it, you know, I saw it.
Before you enlisted, and you said your wife and daughter ended up in New York City, and you were in San Francisco and then Vietnam, had you left Puerto Rico before? Had you traveled outside of Puerto Rico?
Yes. I had to finish my story about my education in Puerto Rico. When I finished college, University of Puerto Rico, I didn't aspire to become a physician because there's no money. I didn't think I could afford to go to medical school with no funding. So I decided, and because my mother had been, you know, getting old, and you know, I saw her working all her life, I figured that it was time for me to go to work. So when I finished my college degree, I had a major in chemistry, I decided to go and work. So I worked with the with a paper company in Puerto Rico, International Paper Company. At that time, the government of Puerto Rico was providing tax incentives for American companies to move to Puerto Rico, so that they can provide jobs for the community there. Because up to that point, Puerto Rico was very poor and primarily dependent on agriculture, cane sugar. That was it. So the governor of Puerto Rico at that time decided to provide tax incentives, bring a lot of companies to Puerto Rico. One of them was the company called International Paper Company, which is a big company in the United States. And I went to work as a chemist when I finished my college degree, and I worked there for a year and a half. Again, realizing that Puerto Ricans with the same degree as I was a chemist, compared to the Americans that were brought in from the United States to work in Puerto Rico, I was making a quarter of the salary that they were making, just because they were Americans and I was a Puerto Rican. And the government obviously allowed that because that was the only way that the companies would move to Puerto Rico. So after a year and a half of making, you know, a quarter of the salary that a person with the same experience and the same education was making, I said, well, this is discrimination. I cannot. Then that's when I really start to think about medicine. I need to be independent. I cannot depend on this, you know, vagaries of how people are going to deal with me, or being a Puerto Rican or being minority or whatever. So after a year and a half, I went to visit my wife now. At that time, we had met in my hometown, and we established a relationship, and she asked me to go and visit her parents in New York. My wife is what we call New Rican. She was born and raised in New York, but from Puerto Rican parents who had moved from my hometown to the United States in the 30s. So I went to New York for 2 weeks, or 1 week, I think, just to visit. That was my first trip to outside of Puerto Rico. And then I met her parents, and then a friend of mine, again, another lucky strike, who I saw in New York during that visit. He was working in New York as a chemist. And he said, why don't you come and work in New York? I can help you getting a job here. And so I thought about it. I said, well, you know, that would be good. I can be with my girlfriend closer. So that's what I did, you know, primarily based on that discrimination that I saw in Puerto Rico. So I went to New York about 3 months after I had done that visit with a job to work in urology department as a technician, basically. So I worked there for about 8 months, and this friend of mine and myself applied to the medical school from New York, and we were both accepted. So after 8 months in New York, again seeing more discrimination in New York, he and I went back to Puerto Rico. Then I got married before I left New York with my wife. We went to Puerto Rico to study medicine. And then because I didn't have any income, my wife had to work to support me. And she was working as a secretary while I was I was in medical school. So they were paying all my expenses in the medical school, but I had no personal income to provide myself. So my wife was supporting me for 4 years in medical school, and we had no car. We had to take public transport. You know, we do a lot of things that poor people do, a lot of sacrifices, but we had fun. We love it, and we always love music. You know, I think I did not mention that I think one of the sublime things of our life being poor, my mother and my brother and myself, was we love music. We used to sing together. We used to listen to music together. So music was kind of the thing that would made us forget, you know, the environment that we were. And so it continues to be the case. As a matter of fact, I was a musician when I was 14 years old. So music has been always, you know, and even now, when my mother was still alive, I used to call her to sing over the phone so that she could listen to me singing. I used to play saxophone over the phone for her. And now with my brother, who's the only one left of the family, we used to call each other and sing to each other. I played music for him, he sings to me. We talk about music. And this is, you know, popular music. We were not trained to listen to classical music. There was none of that kind. But, you know, the old music, you know, from the big band era, you know, all that, we love that, as well as the music from Latin America as well. So we enjoy music, you know, it's our kind of the thing that joins us together. And so when I was married with my wife in the medical school, we have a lot of limitations financially, but we were very happy, you know, with music. My wife and I were excellent dancers, so we used to dance whenever we could for free. You know, we couldn't afford to go to hotels, but we used to spend an excellent time. So then when I got to Vietnam, my wife had to go to New York, as I told you, and she lived with her parents there with my first daughter. When I finished my commitment in Vietnam, we were assigned to Maryland with the Army, and then my second son was born when I was still in Vietnam. So I didn't see him for the first 5 months of his life. The third son was born when I was assigned in Maryland in a hospital there as part of the armed forces. And that's when finally we finished the three children. And then we finished the armed forces. We went back to Puerto Rico to study dermatology.
And I'm curious. Was there a reason why you picked dermatology? Did it interest you, or?
That's an interesting question, because what I'm trying to look back, and I think it's probably true. When I was in medical school, I had excellent teachers in dermatology. But also, I think I developed the visual acuity to identify things of the skin. You know, dermatology has the advantage of being able to be, it's an organ that you can see. So it was an interest of mine, but I was also thinking about internal medicine, ophthalmology, those were the things that I was interested. When I went to Vietnam, there's no specialists in Vietnam. We are all kind of primary care physicians or surgeons. So they asked me, when they tried to distribute the physicians all over Vietnam, they asked me, what do you want to be called or do, or what do you want to concentrate on doing? I said, I would love to see dermatologic cases. Okay, you're going to be the dermatologist. So as part of the battalion service, you know, I would see a lot of things because it's a very hot and humid environment. So you see a lot of infections, primarily fungal infections, bacterial infections. So with a book, I read and learned and treat. And eventually, apparently, I got good enough that then other battalions used to send patients, you know, soldiers to me to see. And at that point, dermatology was very, very primitive. There was not that many medications, so it was easy to identify medication to treat one thing. Now it's much more complicated. So kind of gravitated to dermatology when I was in Vietnam. And I became a pseudo-dermatologist in Vietnam when I came back to finish my last year in a hospital in Maryland. Then I kept on, you know, doing the same thing. People used to call me and show me cases. By that time, in Maryland, obviously they had dermatologists and everybody was specialized, but they used to always call me to show me interesting dermatologic cases. And I think that between the experience as a medical student in Puerto Rico and the experience that I had in Vietnam, then I think that made my decision to go into derm. And then, so I went back to Puerto Rico with the University of Puerto Rico Medical School, at the University Hospital. I did my first 2 years of training in dermatology.
Mm-hmm. And while you were there, you had, you met someone from Harvard Medical School, you had worked with,
yeah,
and I don't recall
that's
the name.
That's a big serendipity of my life, because that really made my professional life and career. When I was in my second year, Thomas Fitzpatrick, who is probably the most prominent dermatologist of the last century, he wrote the most important textbook in dermatology. I don't have it here. But he wrote the most important textbook in dermatology. This is his picture with me there. When just before he died, yeah.
Oh, up on your shelf.
And there's pictures of him there as well with the faculty. He went to Puerto Rico to study the effect of sunlight on skin. You need to realize that that was in 69. There was no sunscreens back then. Nobody knew exactly what the sunlight, as a matter of fact, that was the time when parents used to tell children, go out and expose to sunlight, that's healthy. So he went to study that, and the study was to bring a medication that was a research medication, a cream, to treat people who develop dark color on the face, primarily induced by sunlight, called melasma. So he wanted to try this cream in a population of patients where sunlight is prevalent and a lot of people suffer the consequences of sun exposure. And Puerto Rico was obviously the best place because, you know, it's easy to travel to Puerto Rico. So when he got there, he asked the chief of the department at the time, Dr. Torres, who was my chief, if somebody was interested in helping, primarily just to do interpreting, you know, because the people that, the subjects that were going to participate in the study were all Spanish speaking. Most of them didn't know any English. And Fitzpatrick and the crew that he brought from Harvard didn't know any Spanish. So I became more or less an interpreter. And the study lasted about a year. But then I got involved more deeply into the actual study besides just being an interpreter. As a matter of fact, I used to travel every 3 months. And in that interim, I would take care of all these patients while they were back in Boston. So for some reason, at the end of that year, Fitzpatrick and John Parrish became the second chief after Fitzpatrick died. Asked me if I wanted to come and finish my training at Harvard. And that was in May. The training would be starting in July the 1st. I didn't know what to say, because I knew that I was competing with people that I thought they were way, way above what I could compete with. Obviously, I would have to leave my family, my mother, back in Puerto Rico. I would have to bring my children, my wife with children, all of them were small. But I saw it as a challenge, you know. And I think I mentioned to you before, to me, I always look to be a pioneer, you know. And I accept challenges, you know. So I told him, yes, I discussed it with my brother, who's much brighter than I am in making decisions, you know. It has an analytical mind much better than mine. And I called him, I said, you know, this is an offer that it was just shocked me. And he says, well, you know, you should think about it, but, you know, it's a great opportunity. And then I called one of my teachers in Puerto Rico. He says, you know, don't think about it, just go. You know, just go, this is a great opportunity. And so I told him, yes. So it was in May to start in July. So I did not apply. I didn't come to Boston for interviews. So I was accepted just by the word that Fitzpatrick brought to the rest of the faculty and the admission committee. Nobody knew who I was. Many faculty assumed that I was very rich in Puerto Rico and I was paying my way through into Harvard, which obviously was not true. So anyway, I came in July the 1st with no application papers, nothing. I just came here and became a resident in my last year of training. And then I finished here. I think I did a good job, because 4 years after, then they recruited me as a faculty member back again. You know, so then I came back in 76 as a faculty member. So it was a lucky strike, you know. And one of the things that I keep on preaching for the why I defend minorities and diversity is because you should not depend on lucky strikes, you know. You should be accepted for the skills that you have and the quality of the service that you provide. If you depend on lucky strikes, in my case, for example, obviously, I would not have been here, you know. Not that I diminish my contribution, but at that point, for somebody like Fitzpatrick, who was the biggest dermatologist of last century, to pay attention to me, breed me, with basically taking a risk in me against the rest of the faculty who didn't know who I was and why I was coming here, it's a lucky strike that is very difficult to comprehend. And I used to talk to Fitzpatrick always after I came back, why did you selected me? Why? He said, well, Ernesto, you're not a minority, you're not a Puerto Rican, you're not this. you're just somebody that I respect and I admire what you have done in your life. And I said, you know, it's funny, because Fitzpatrick was a bigot. You know, he didn't like African Americans, he didn't like Jews, he didn't like women. He always had some negative things to say about them, even though we had Jews, we had women, we have minorities like myself. But one of the interesting things was we never had really an African American, you know, except for one in our department, never really. So now we have 3 Puerto Ricans in this department, but never really had an African American except for one. So somehow that continued, you know, through the years. But he would say, no, no, you are not Puerto Rican, you are not Hispanic. All the other Hispanics are lazy people, but you are different. So somehow he liked me, you know. And the people used to say I'm one of Fitzpatrick's boys, you know, when I came here. But so it was a very interesting experience, which obviously made my professional career, because as I told you, my father died so early in my life that really never had a paternal figure, but he was my paternal professional figure. I always admired him, always aspired to be as good as he was. We had a very, very close relationship, and it was beyond just professional things. He always was, you know, aware of my family needs, my children. He always embellished my things, you know, the things that I would do. He would say that I was the best to everybody, especially in the Hispanic world in dermatology, which was very narrow, very small at the time. He would always say that I was the best dermatologist there was, or whatever, which again, to me, was a lot of embellishment. But we had that excellent relationship, and I still consider him the one who made my life, you know, career-wise.
And so he brought you back to...
Yes. 4 years after when I finished my training here in 72, I went back to Puerto Rico thinking that I would never come back to the United States. I was supposed to develop an immunology lab there, which is one of the things that I trained when I was here in the University of Puerto Rico. And I started to work with the University of Puerto Rico Medical School in dermatology there as a faculty member there. And we used to see each other once a year at the academy meetings of dermatology. We used to say hello and things like that. Always asking me, you know, are you interested in coming back? I would say, no, no, no. I'm set in Puerto Rico. I don't want to be far away from my family again, my mother especially. And then in 75, he says, send me a letter. So Ernesto, could you consider coming back? And at that point, I was ready. Yeah, because I had a lot of aspirations in Puerto Rico and they did not materialize professionally. I was happy with my family life and everything, but professionally, I didn't feel that I was going to be making any impact, you know, working in Puerto Rico. And so I accepted the position. The position was to become the first director of phototherapy in the nation. That was because part of the studies that we did in Puerto Rico was to develop a treatment for people with dermatologic disease called psoriasis, and the treatment was to offer these patients light treatment, mimicking what sunlight does, developing units that provide UV light to treat people with psoriasis. And so it was all developed here. And so I was part of that study in a sense, because, you know, this was the genesis of what I did in Puerto Rico with him in research. And so he gave me a position for 2 years. It was a contract for 2 years to become the first director of a phototherapy unit. And that will be, again, patient with psoriasis that will have these units in this hospital at the MGH and get the treatment with light, which turned out to be huge thing, because it revolutionized not only psoriasis treatment, but revolutionized about 20 other diseases that are amenable to be treated with lights. So all that was developed here. So in a sense, I was the pioneer. Obviously, Fitzpatrick and John Parrish are the ones who developed the whole system, but I was the one who used to see the patients, administer the treatment, follow these patients for many, many years. So that's how I came. And my salary was $35,000, which back then might have looked good, but it was very, very, very small amount of money bringing a family with three children to Boston for the second time. But I accepted it. And then it grew very quickly. After a year and a half, they made me the chief of the whole dermatology clinic at the MGH, which I did for 10 years. And obviously my salary increased as I moved along. But that was a big risk for us to take, me and my family. But my wife was ready to come back again. She always feel that she's more a continental person than a Puerto Rican person. I'm the opposite. And she was ready to come back to the United States. So we struggled for a few years and financially, but eventually it was the right decision. And unfortunately, the only regret that I have is that it was 65 when I left my mother in Puerto Rico. When I came in 76, she was already 65 years of age. And you don't think about those things because she was still relatively healthy, and I was so involved with my professional career and also my family issues too, that I never really thought that I was going to abandon my mother at such a late age in her life. But she was always very positive about, you know, anything that would be for progress. She would go on with it. She would say, forget about me, go and do it. This is a tremendous progress for you and for your professional career. My brother was the same, stimulating me all the time, you know, to go further. So I had the support from my family, even though later on when she got sick and older, then I realized that it might have been a big mistake for me to leave Puerto Rico. And I always regret that, you know, I always have a guilty feeling that I abandoned